Welcome to Pacific Conversations. We're joined today to discuss the impact of media concentration and social media on American and Australian politics. Stephanie Zenega-Marr is the Democrats Abroad Australia Global Black Caucus Chair and a lifelong lover of politics. Tess Connery is a journalist for Media Week, Australia's media industry Bible, and a former breakfast host for 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. Ed Blakely is a former Washington insider, an internationally recognised leader in urban development and planning, advisor and author. And my name is Sean Britton, radio journalist and co-host of the podcast, US of Ed.
Well, colleagues, because one doesn't say I have two ladies, but these days we're going genderless, or and that's not the important feature. The important thing here in this set of programs, series, is podcasts, and we've done several already. We'll open up for the full year around, starting in April, because we want to have a backlog of these around certain themes. And the theme we're talking about just now is the media, which will be very appropriate to open up, because the media is shaping how people view Australia from the United States. The media is shaping how the United States views the world at this juncture. And the media is the message, as Marshall McLuhan said. So let's get out. I want to start with the first part of this is, how did Trump reshape the media and the message? Stephanie?
I think Trump really opened up a new era where people became aware of the power of social media and the power of Twitter and the power of one individual to really bypass some of the traditional gatekeepers and channels that we had for, you know, a couple hundred years since the first printed newspaper, where all of a sudden it wasn't the media and, you know, capital T, capital M, controlling the narrative. Is one individual really kind of untethered and uncensored and, you know, unhinged at times, wanted out to the people directly via Twitter. So he really did reshape how people consume information, whether it's correct information or false information.
Tess, speaking of falseness, there was a very big false information approach. But it didn't stop in the United States. We had some of it here in Australia. There are people out, there's now the anti-vaxxers and other groups trying to create their information. I saw something the other day where somebody says, we have discovered here in Australia how to cure COVID. All the other stuff is fake. How has fake news influenced Australia?
Yeah, I mean, Australia historically does like to follow in the footsteps of America to an extent, doesn't it? And the sheer amount of falsehoods that Trump was spewing at one point there, you know, there were a couple of different numbers that got tossed around, but all of them were just far too high to sort of wrap your head around. And when you've got that many lies coming at you, quicker than you can fact check them, things are going to go through to the keeper. You know, you can only focus on so much in a situation like that. And I think a lot of, you know, people around the world, not even necessarily just in Australia, a lot of outlets and a lot of individuals saw that this strategy, I guess, if you want to call it, of just putting too much information out there to fact check was actually working in a lot of ways. It was getting the narrative that Trump and the Republicans wanted, or, you know, again, like you mentioned, the anti-vaxxers, anybody who's sort of taken this strategy up, it's getting the message out there because there's just too much information to fact check. So I think it is something that if you had said, you know, 5-10 years ago, the best way to do this is to just completely lie until you can't lie anymore, people would have laughed at you. But we've seen this strategy in action, and we've seen it work. We've seen the impact that it does have. So I think, you know, if you
are going to go on,
I think it's I think it is going to go on. I think it's going to be very hard to shake. Maybe it won't go on forever, but again, if you are in one of these positions and you've seen how much success people have had with just spreading this information without any rhyme or reason, I think you'd be mad not to try it out yourself.
I think
both of you, go ahead, Sean.
I was going to say, I think, yeah, the genie is well out of the bottle in that sort of circumstance. It sort of reminds me what you're saying, Tess, of the old quotation, a lie can be halfway around the world, you know, before the truth has its pants on. I do question, though, why it is that the truth tellers, or some aspects of truth tellers, or different sides of politics seem to struggle with their messaging, getting their messaging out through the same mediums as these ones that are relying on a great deal of falsehoods and more emotive claims.
One of the things that's really interesting about that is that, and not to kind of put people into an either or camp, but traditionally, you know, the more, I guess, old school Democrats have kind of gone through the more traditional media channels. You know, they're pushing their message out through network and cable news outlets that are more established and traditional. So they kind of have the, I guess they're just more traditional in terms of how they're releasing their story. Whereas, you know, Trump really did create shockwaves in this landscape, and he really did disrupt that sort of messaging style.
Can we bring it back?
We don't know if we can, because I think, again, it might have to do with where people find their commonality, or where they're, you know, the things that they align to. So for example, I don't necessarily go to Donald Trump's Twitter feed when he had one to get my news, because that did not align with my values and my beliefs and what I wanted to see every day. However, I would happily watch CNN or, you know, MSNBC or some of the liberal media sources as they got labeled.
Your truth.
That's where I found my truth. So how do we get people, you know, in a world where we really have thousands of different outlets and channels and Twitter feeds and whatnot, back to that kind of older style of news and journalism, where it's the four networks in the US, or the, you know, the eight networks, or the, you know, the main papers of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and the Tribune as, you know, newspapers of record, where really it's become so splintered and fractured that everybody, anyone with an opinion, can put it up on Twitter, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, I heard the world was flat. Really? Well, people just retweeted that, so maybe it is. Like, hang on a second. And you don't have that same rigor that we are, that traditionally. Well,
but the understanding all that, it makes, Tess, it makes the notion of voting very hard. Because what am I voting for? I get a presentation. This person's to the left, they're to the right, they're for large cookies. I just saw it the other day where someone in US Congress was saying, Black people are against families. What? Before the Congress, knowing that that would be a soundbite.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's always been an element of, you know, politicians lying to get their way. I don't think that's anything new. What I think is new is the extent of the claims that get made in efforts to, you know, win votes or whatever it is they may be setting out to do. You know, once upon a time, it would have been claims, I don't know, you know, however far back you want to look. But these days, you know, it's vote for me because the election is rigged, you know, and we will, you know, we will, I will actually, I'm not actually sure what their point is, but, you know, we vote for us because the election is rigged, etc. So it's a strange situation, particularly in America, because they don't have the preference voting system. I think that it has going to have an impact as well.
Do you think, now Americans in journalism, who are people like you, are paid to do information, but there are other people like me, podcast, I'm not paid to do information. Kind of every flower can bloom, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, with YouTube and this tube and that tube and so on, how will a young person be able to discern the source of truth?
It's a big question. I think young people, I think, particularly the generation coming up, who are, you know, sort of teenagers and young adults right now, are incredibly technologically savvy. And I like to have hope that, you know, they are going to be a lot better at sort of picking where the truth lies than perhaps, you know, we think straight off the bat. But yeah, when you do have this oversaturation of people giving information, it can be very, very difficult to pick through it all, impossible to pick through all of it and work out exactly what is right and wrong.
Would it be a good idea for us in high schools and so forth to have people start their own radio and television programs so they learn about how you craft messages and craft the truth?
I think it's important for children at, you know, starting very early. I have a four-year-old son, and the amount of information and things that he's getting from YouTube Kids and all these different sources, I think you just have to start kids really early learning what's opinion and what's fact. Mm-hmm. And really understand the difference between someone putting up on YouTube, you know, some brain dump of what they feel that day versus what you might read in a paper of record like the Sydney Morning Herald, and understanding the sources of information that are going to be coming at them at a million miles an hour, and then how to really kind of question, well, where is that coming from? How did they get this information? Where's the data to support what they're saying versus someone who just wants to stand essentially on a street corner and yell into the abyss, which is basically what YouTube is. I mean,
but remember, young people are spending more time with the tube than they are with their parents.
Yeah, 100%. I'm guilty of that 100%, giving my son the phone while we're in the car and, you know, watch what you want within reason. But that's why I think we really do have to teach our children even before they get to high school, you know, before they have to write that first book report.
Yeah,
where they
how do we craft this, Tess? Your Media Week is for all media, right?
We are, yes. I agree with Stephanie. I think maybe the way to go about it is, you know, you take it further ahead, even earlier than high school. But I don't think necessarily you go ahead with getting students to make their own radio or TV program. I think where that energy would probably be better spent is teaching critical thinking, media literacy, going down that line instead of, you know, because just because they know how it works, I think doesn't necessarily mean people will then go ahead and, you know, perhaps they say, oh, well, I know how this is done. Fantastic. So that's how this person does it. Therefore, everything they say is true. And who knows where that could end up. I think critical thinking skills and media literacy are very important and are going to be increasingly so, because like you said, there is just so much content out there these days.
There's so much information. I would call it all content. Maybe it's disinformation. So, you know, in my year, we read 1984, you know, the information, the Ministry of Truth was just spread falsehoods.
Circling back on sort of the part of the point you were making earlier there about, you know, people like yourself and myself putting podcasts out there in the world from outside of media organizations, I think that's an interesting one to revisit when we're talking about, you know, the media literacy and the glut of information that's out there. Because for one, obviously that increases the amount of information that's out there. But on the other hand of that, when the internet first came in, it was kind of seen as this possible great equalizer.
Yes.
Everyone would have this equal voice, you know, podcasts, YouTubes, whatever it is, blogs, obviously back then, because it was mostly written words. It was seen as the great equalizer, but we haven't really seen that dream come to the fore. So when we're discussing some of these bits and pieces about the glut of information, I think it's worth remembering traditional media, those media stalwarts, whether for good or bad, are still securing their position front and center in the conversation that is happening online. I mean, we've seen the latest debate around Facebook and media companies being paid on Facebook. That was mainstream media companies that were leading that charge and still trying to gain and sort of forcing themselves in front of as many eyeballs as possible. So we still have those traditional media sources really dominating the conversation.
But let's turn this Australia first. Facebook shut them down. Did that happen in the US too? Or is it just a Australian phenomenon? And if not, if it's only an Australian phenomenon, should it be recommended? Because I'd like to see some newspapers in my wife's hometown have disappeared.
Mm.
It was just an Australian thing. It didn't happen overseas. It was in response to the mandatory media bargaining code laws that the government...
Explain more about this, because some of our listeners are in the US, so they're not going to know about it.
Oh, of course. So the idea behind the mandatory bargaining code law was there was a lot of nitty gritty, but really the major point it came down to was the government saying that publishing platforms, Google and Facebook being the two big ones, should be paying Australian news organisations for their content. So, you know, our sort of ABC, Sydney Morning Herald, you know, The Guardian, The Australian, the big, well, as well as some of the smaller ones, but mostly bigger media organisations should be paid for the content, because the idea was that people are visiting Google and Facebook to get their news. As you can imagine, this didn't make Google or Facebook very happy. Google threatened to pull out of the country. They didn't end up doing that. And Facebook threatened that if we have to pay for news, then I guess we'll just ban news. And no one really took them seriously until we woke up on a Thursday to find we had no news on Facebook. It lasted about a week before our, there was a couple of government ministers got on the phone with Mark Zuckerberg and sorted it out. And we've got news back now. But for a week there, it was a little bit of the Wild West, not really knowing what was going on.
But this is instructive, I think, for the United States. If you're living in a small town in Iowa and you're getting, doesn't matter whether it's Fox or MSNBC, you don't know what's going on in Iowa, right?
Yeah.
Beth, how do people in the smaller communities get news anymore?
That's a real, you know, issue, because, you know, we're not paying what we should for our news outlets, and we're not paying our journalists what we should be paying them. Personally, you know, when I, like, I'm one of those old school people who I still like to read a newspaper. It doesn't happen very often, but I still actually subscribe to the digital edition of the Sydney Morning Herald and the New York Times and the Washington Post, because I value the service and getting news and being able to read, you know, more than 10 free articles a month. But I think we need to get people back into the habit of either buying a newspaper or thinking of, I'm going to buy today's content from this.
But what about the smaller town, Waterloo, Iowa, or Jonestown, Mississippi? They used to have a newspaper. Those newspapers, the independent ones, are gone. How do we get that back? Because I think that was a source of real debate, because you know what's going on the school board. You know what's happening with the soccer teams and so on. Isn't that what democracy is about? Being informed about how you can participate, right? Is that going to happen from this code?
As in, will...
the Albury newspaper come back? The Murray Times or whatever it was?
I think that was the idea, but at the same time, I'm not too sure, because, you know, with COVID coming through, any money that was going to go through to these companies after COVID, you know, there's so many places that it could be dispersed to. I'm not sure it would go towards refunding, you know, some of the smaller newspapers that got shut down. And a couple of years ago, there was quite a big cut of local newspapers as well that we haven't necessarily seen reversed. I think we are seeing a sort of a rise of more independent, smaller community newspapers and newsletters. I know in my hometown where my parents are, there's you know, there's like a little community newsletter. I'm not actually sure who runs it, to be honest. I should find out. But
probably volunteers.
Probably volunteers, and it ends up in people's mailboxes and things like that, which is really good, because even before the Facebook news ban, a lot of older residents who didn't want to or didn't know how to use Facebook were already sort of suffering some of the effects that you mentioned, in terms of losing some of the local papers and things like that. You know, with Facebook removing news, it kind of affected the entire population. But
it's an ecosystem, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Seth, you're going to say.
I was going to say, what we are seeing it with Facebook and with social media, though, is that people are connecting to each other within their local community. And so they might be putting up things in terms of counselor so-and-so, you know, at whoever, at Botany Council, can you please fix my X, Y, and Z. It's not coming through a news outlet. You know, I don't think they're going to, you know, let the big news organizations see value in local newspapers anymore. But I think people are getting their local news from social media and from groups and more affinity sources.
But that can be really skewed. Like, if there's a debate in a community, the people who are against something get most of the attention, and the people who are for are kind of shoved out in smaller communities, right? How do they get their voices heard?
But I think that's the same with any, you know, anytime someone writes an opinion piece or a perspective or, you know, we forget that even journalism can be slightly skewed and slanted depending on who's writing it and the point of view that they have. So I think in some ways, social media groups are, you know, yes, it is whoever shouts the loudest will win, but that's kind of not too different from traditional news sources.
I guess you're right. I mean, clearly we're an example here. We're putting on, creating not news, but information on a platform. If that platform weren't here, it'd be very hard to communicate, right? Now, we got in this to keep the 30-minute situation. What are some lessons, starting with you, Tess, from this media law that was created? You think these are lessons for the United States and other countries trying to bring back the localization of the media? Because I about doubt if any newspaper in the United States has an international reporter anymore.
I think the biggest lesson from it, to be honest, was just how powerful Facebook is as an entity, which we all knew it in theory, but I'm not sure any of us had quite seen it in practice. So I think that was kind of the biggest takeaway. And I anticipate that there'll be some repercussions of this that go further, you know, further into the future, even though the news has been restored to Facebook in Australia. I think that's kind of the number one takeaway, is just how much of a monolith Facebook is in our lives. But I agree with you. You know, when we didn't know if we were going to get the news content back on Facebook, it was still through other social media and places like that. But when we didn't know what the situation was, there was a real sense of concern that a lot of people, certainly that I, you know, interact with on Facebook had, and pages that I follow were posting about, this is going to become a situation where, as you sort of mentioned earlier, people can get on their soapbox, scream the loudest, and then who's going to be able to back that up? Who's going to be able to come up against that if it needs to be argued against? So I think it really, the lessons were outside of, like I said, the sort of monolith of Facebook, is that local news and accurate news is incredibly important. And the way that we live our lives now, news and social media is just so entwined that it's
you
can't detangle the two. And so I think that's another point as well, is that it's almost, for a lot of people, like you said, particularly people in very rural areas where the local paper might have shut down and their neighbor might be 10 kilometers down the road, and they don't necessarily hear a lot of what's happening. I think it's a really important way to stay connected, and we need to really think about what some of the implications of that are.
Steph?
I think, you know, one of the things that came to mind while you're talking, Tess, is, you know, people not necessarily questioning where their news comes from. And one of the things about Facebook is it's very easy to share. to the point where sometimes things that are shared, they become fact. I can't remember how long ago it was a couple months ago. One of the outlets reported something from the Batuta Advocate as fact. And it was like, hang on, this is a satire newspaper. How did, or a satire, you know, email newsletter even, how did this become reported as if it's true? And it's because people don't question. People look at Facebook, they press share, and they don't do that next level of, okay, what's the source? Where am I getting this from? And I think if we've learned anything, or if I learned anything, it's that, you know what, news still exists outside of Facebook. You could still go on to directly to the news outlet website and get your news. So I think people just need to get back into that sort of rigor of actually doing a little bit of digging on their own rather than having everything served up to them on the Facebook platter.
The last issue I want to bring to you is, you know, Facebook, all this kind of stuff is nice. But my real concern is, how do we train people to be reporters, investigators, and all those kinds of skills that used to be the school of journalism's province and the like? Because it's investigative journalism that's kept a lot of the bad things at bay, not the big media outlets. How do we continue that for our democracies in both countries? Because the big guys can squash you down. If they can turn Trump off, they can turn you off. How do we get through that?
I'm not sure I have an answer for that, to be honest. It's a big question, and it's absolutely something that you know, we're going to need to look at as a society, because you're right, the implications of not having that are more concerning than what we've already sort of lived through. But it's a big question, I suppose. My gut feeling is that it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, and, you know, teaching kids high school, younger than high school, going back to those critical thinking skills, those media literacy skills. And I think growing up in the world that they are, I think a lot of those kids are, they're starting off on the right foot in that regards. They've got a bit of a head start on some of us, but it's a big question, and I'm not 100% sure, to be honest with you.
There is a question of responsibility, I think, in that, in terms of, well, the responsibility that Facebook or any other social media site has to deliver accurate news. That's not what they were there for originally. They didn't set out with that as a mandate.
Pass-throughs.
And people have gotten themselves in their own bubbles by liking only what they like, sharing only what they're going to share. And there's sort of, okay, there's a level of personal responsibility, but you kind of can't expect everybody to have that level of responsibility for themselves. So you ask, well, the platforms themselves, what responsibilities do they now share as a place where people are getting so much of their news to share that news accurately? And obviously, as you mentioned, Ed, deplatforming is an incredibly powerful tool for these ones at the moment. I don't think we've got any indication that these guys will necessarily use those powers responsibly, and they don't feel that responsibility as of yet.
Yeah, there could be another Trump from the left. You know, we certainly have had people rise from the left, same kind of ideology that was very wrong-headed, but fortunately they burned out. I guess one of the things I'm thinking about, and I think both the United States and Australia should do this, is when I was young, we had these young people's conferences sponsored by the social, the Rotaries and so on. And these were platforms. We had to write a newspaper for the Rotary summer program. We had to get up in the state legislature and make a speech for something that we wanted to have happen. You can actually use these forums for good, to spread this in a wider way. Why, if a school doesn't have a journalism program, the district could hire Sean or Tess to run, you know, or Stephanie to run a four-week program, and kids could contribute to that. I think we are thinking about how to kill the giant but not grow the bean. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great point, because as long as people are still intellectually curious, there have always been people who want to tell the story of what's happening in the world. Going back thousands of years to the very beginning of human history, there have always been storytellers, and journalists are storytellers. So I don't think we're in danger of journalism disappearing, but I think we need to really put a very close eye on how that information is portrayed and who's telling it, and really use those critical thinking.
And think of the truth as like a ruler, that there, you've got to gauge everything that comes across to you against some set of standards. That critical thinking is clearly what we have to do in schools, but we have to do it elsewhere. It was surprising to me how many people during some of this business, big lie thing, had given up their ability to think because they were told not to. Now, I'm old as to remember, I wasn't part of it, but this happened in Germany. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was born in 38. In 39, it was at full force. So I heard about it as a kid, but not everyone, you know, I kind of grew up with this thing, this can happen here, and we were damn close. So I think this is a conversation we could continue across the Pacific and maybe have it the conversation that continues in every living room and every community about how they make and control their own information for their own good.
To find out more about Pacific Conversations, visit the website edtalks.com.au and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss a thing. For weekly US news and current affairs, check out Ed and I's other podcast, US of Ed, wherever you find good podcasts, as well as on Facebook and Twitter.